Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. It's very good to see so many friends here. See this room full with Dhamma practitioners is very inspiring and rewarding. So Hemanta has kindly invited us to this dana to remember her mother who died 3 months ago, and then we also have a chance to reflect on our parents and loved ones. And this is a lovely tradition in Theravada Buddhism. For those of you who are not familiar with it, quite often when someone dies in the family, someone we know, a friend, then the 7th day after the dana, often after the death, a dana is offered to the sangha, either in a home, in a person's home, or at the monastery, and then on the 3rd month, 3 months after the person has passed away, a dana is offered again at home or at the monastery, and then every year a memorial dana is offered. And this is a kind of lovely tradition that remembers the most important people in our lives. Puts us in a context of who we are and how we've arrived here. If you think just when we begin this session, we pay homage to the Buddha. We always pay homage to the Buddha. We always do that because that's our reference point. We wouldn't be here if it were not for the Buddha. We wouldn't be practicing this lovely Dhamma if it were not for the Buddha. And so also our parents, we wouldn't have this opportunity if it were not for our parents. We wouldn't be able to practice Dhamma. So we at the very least, we owe them that much for human birth. And human birth is such a valuable opportunity, such a rare opportunity, really. We come from our mother's body. We are born of a mother. So this is a common thread that runs through all our lives. This joins us in this particular way. We are fed from a mother's body. That's how we begin life. The first nurturing energy, the first caring energy comes from our mother. And then dad joins in. So our father then conditions us and helps us. And so these two people are so tremendously important in our lives. And the intensity that exists in childhood and in infancy is an intensity which we have as children, but we're not aware of. Our parents are aware of it, but we aren't. We're more passive. And what our parents do for us, what they go through for us, what the self-sacrifices they make for us, we can't really know. Maybe we know it when we have children. Well, I've never had children, so I haven't experienced that. But parents often tell me that. I really realize what my mom and dad did for me. When I had children, when I realized the sacrifices involved, the incredible affection that's involved, the love that's involved, the caring that's involved. So this very, very a powerful relationship that we have with our mother or with our father, with our mother in Hemanta's case, matures and changes. Eventually we go our own way, we have our own vocation, our own family, and the bond is still strong, but we are busy with other things. We're concerned about our own career and our family and how to make it in the world and where to go and so on. And unfortunately, in this modern age, our families get very much torn apart. So Hemanta was here and her mother was in Sri Lanka. And I know when I was in New Zealand and my mother was here, this is very painful. This is quite painful. As our elders get older, this is a kind of difficult cultural thing now that many people face. So we're quite often torn. We've got two responsibilities, the family here and parents over there, wherever over there might be. And that can be quite painful. So it's good to reflect that these situations are quite often bigger than us. We would like to be in both places at one time, but we can't. Life is just that way. So we have to have a sense of, I think, just accepting the fact that we've done the best we could. Can't be there all the time. We'd like to be there all the time. So as we mature and as we grow, then if our parents live to a ripe old age, and if we have the possibility, we begin to see their vulnerability. In the beginning, we as infants are very vulnerable, and we receive their care and their love and their nurturing, and then there's that time where they become vulnerable. But now it's not an infant and an adult. It's two adults. It's two beings who have the maturity to understand what it means to be vulnerable, what it means to care and be cared for. And this can be a very lovely time, very, very lovely time, an opportunity to share one's heartfelt love of a person. And often, you know, with our parents, they're, you know, it's not like we get along with them all the time. We have our difficulties and so on. But as they become more vulnerable, we really, you know, I think something arises in our minds which is very affectionate and very caring. And this is a lovely thing to develop, a lovely opportunity. And then as they approach their death, we feel vulnerable too. This is a huge loss because our parents have always been part of our universe. My mother has always been part of my universe until she dies. My dad was always a part of my universe until he died. And to enter into that kind of relationship of affection and vulnerability brings up a lot of emotions, very strong emotions, all kinds of maybe childhood emotions and or feelings of helplessness or whatever it might be. But on the whole, it opens the heart, doesn't it? It opens the heart in a profound way. And it's not just a little meditation. It's a very profound kind of thing. And then our parents die, or we die before them. And this is in the nature of things, and this is the Dhamma, that which has a nature to be born has a nature to die. Can't be any other way. And then we feel the grief of that. We feel the loss. And that's a part of being human also. And that, to taking that on board, that grief and loss and vulnerability and affection, these very deep experiences we have as human beings, allowing them to come through us, I think, makes us truly compassionate human beings. Because when we feel vulnerable, when we feel the pain of the loss of someone, we feel that grief, there's something which, it lessens our ego, doesn't it? It brings, I think, more humility, more love, and a more understanding of other people's suffering. Anyone who has suffered the death of a friend or a person in the family and gone through that understands the death of all people or the grief that people feel around the death of someone. So it deepens our humanity, definitely, if it deepens our humanity. So there's nothing wrong with grief. There's nothing wrong with being vulnerable. If we didn't have those, I think we could become very cold beings. And Buddhism isn't just a cold, analytical teaching. It's a very deep, heartfelt teaching. If you think about the Brahmaviharas, how profound they are, metta, karuna, mudita, upeka, how profound those feelings can be in the human heart. And the Buddha asked us to cultivate those in a way which is unlimited. Now, I often contemplate unlimited metta, unlimited karuna, mudita, upeka, unlimited to all beings everywhere. That's very hard to do. Very hard to do. But when we are touched in this way with the kind of universal human problem of birth and death, and we contemplate on that level that, as we all like to say in from the Thai tradition, that we are brothers and sisters in old age, sickness, and death. This is our common bond. Then that helps us in our tendency to be very alienated and separated from each other, because we're common in this. And this kind of a dana then is lovely. It's a lovely part of our tradition, where we do come together, where we support each other, where we remember, where we enjoy a good meal together, and then we think of the person that's died. And we say, whatever way this works, however this universe works, may the goodness of this day be of benefit to those I love, to those I care for. We don't know how it works, but that sentiment, that emotion, we can bring that forth. We can bring forth gratitude, and these occasions allow for that. If we don't have these occasions, if we just live in a secular culture and we forget, then that depth of heart sometimes doesn't have the rituals to trigger off these very healthy, open human emotions. And that's the downside of a secular a culture where these kinds of things, we don't have the opportunity. The downside of a religious culture is superstition. So quite often when we have like traditional Buddhist gatherings for ceremonies, there might be a lot of superstition around things. So we have to do things. But superstition is based on fear. I have to do something right so that I don't get some kind of bad karmic result. But this kind of gathering ritual is not based on fear. It's based on love. It's based on gratitude. It's based on humility. It's based on goodness. So you can't get it wrong. If you don't pour the water right, don't worry about it. If the water spills on the carpet, no problem. If there's not enough water in the jug, no problem. If you forget to do the water prayer, no problem. The superstition, the way superstition works is, you know, maybe you spilled some water on the carpet. Oh, my mother will have a bad rebirth because I spilled water on the carpet. That would be silly, wouldn't it? And that would be fear. And that's the downside of traditional cultural forms, traditional rituals that people think, well, you need to do something. You know, the neighbors had 15 monks, so we better get 17 monks, right? That's all fear, superstition, peer group pressure, but it's not love. It's not compassion. It's not humility. It's just bad Buddhism, if you think about it. Whereas love can, you know, we don't need monks for this. We can get together and remember those we love. We don't really need that. But this vehicle that we have allows for that. It allows for the doing that. And this is very good. This is one of the things I think that, say, the Sri Lankan communities and the Thai communities, Southeast Asian Buddhist communities can offer to Western religion. Because Western Buddhism often comes from meditation and the intellectual philosophy of Buddhism, and those heartfelt traditions and rituals and gatherings of a community are often missing. You know, people know how to do that, and then when they see how it's done, they say, "Oh, that's a nice thing to do. That's a good thing to do," and people pick up on it. So our development of this monastery, it's interesting because we have the traditional Buddhist community coming together with Western Buddhists who are new to this, and there's a great mixing. There's a great respect for both parts of this interesting evolution. One, of course, when someone dies, you know, often the thoughts about rebirth come up. What will be the rebirth of this person, and so on, and we speculate about that. We don't really know. But what we can know for sure is that our intentions, the motivation that we live by, the intentions of our action, the intentions of our speech, the intentions of our thought, the motivations behind my thinking, my speaking, my acting, that has a result. That has a result for sure. I can see that if I am considerate to others, then my heart has less alienation. People tend to be considerate to me. If I'm abusive of others, I tend to be alienated from others, and I'm not very happy. It can't be very, very happy. So intention is, of course, the guiding factor for whatever rebirth might be. And intention is like the steering wheel. It really is like what's steering your vehicle. And what we try to do in a Buddhist practice is become fully conscious and fully cognizant of all our intentions. And it's hard to do. First of all, to be fully conscious, to actually know that you're here now. It doesn't sound like much, but quite often we kind of know we're here, but we're thinking about the future. We're anticipating, we're planning, or we're criticizing, or we're judging, or we're just distracted by something. But to be fully conscious, to be really present, means you have to stop. You don't have to stop doing anything, but you have to stop your mind from going to the past and future. You have to bring the mind into the present moment. That's one of the things we're trying to do in meditation. We're trying to bring that awakened consciousness and realize what it means to be fully present, fully with the moment. Because it's only when we do that that we can make clear intentions, and they have great power. When we talk about the analysis of any conscious moment in Buddhism, there are kind of many factors that are mentioned. One is that the consciousness is a flow of events, one event conditioning another event and so on. And within each conscious event, there is, first of all, the sense base that's operating. So there's eye consciousness, or there's tongue consciousness, so there's sound or sight. So one of the sense bases is functioning, right? There's also the quality of the experience, whether the Vedana, whether it's attractive or not attractive. And that's a whole range of experiences. Some experience we're drawn to in a passionate way, some we're kind of interested in, some we're repelled by, some we're frightened by. So there's this push and pull going on in each conscious moment. We're contacting. Contact is one of the things we talk about, that the eye is contacting objects. The mind is contacting thought objects. And what is most important in this analysis of any mind moment is that each mind moment has in it intention. This is the way Buddhism describes our conscious experience. Each mind moment, each moment of consciousness has intention embedded in it. Thought is intentional. Speech is intentional. Action is intentional. But we can be intentional but not fully conscious. So let's say if I am just worried about something and I'm not conscious of that worry, there's still intention. The mind is still making, you're still driving the vehicle in some half-hearted way, and the intentions are towards worry, towards worry, towards worry. And you can see how that's not a very good rebirth. Because tomorrow morning we wake up with that intention, and that intention becomes stronger. So because we're heedless, and because we're not attentive, we're not awake, and we're not making conscious intentions, then the result is a vipaka, or resultant karma, which isn't very good. It's confused. It's frightened. It's worried, or whatever. But the moment we wake up, we awake to the fact, wow, this is a lot of worry going on here. That moment of consciousness is the beginning of good karma, isn't it? I awaken. I know what's going on. I know the content of my consciousness. I know whether it's wholesome or unwholesome. And in that moment, I can make skillful choices. So if my mind has been just habitually worrying, I awake to that and I say, I'm going to notice something else. I'm not going to go there. I'm going to try to notice my breath. Or I'm going to bring up faith or something, right? I make a conscious decision to do a wholesome action. Now that has great power. And that's good karma, isn't it? That's good intention, a right intention. And that right intention has good results. So when we're fully conscious, and when we make conscious decisions, when we're motivated and we direct our minds from panya, from wisdom, from understanding, from compassion, then the results are very powerful. Are very, very powerful, because we're really kind of driving the vehicle now in the right direction. And then, of course, we get lost. We get lost in our complaining or our fearfulness or just distracted by life. It gets too busy. And then something, we remember Bhutto, the awakened mind. And this is what life is like now. And then we make clear intentions. And this life of clear intention and full consciousness is a life of mindfulness, It's a life of right understanding. It's a life of right thinking. It begins with right understanding, because right understanding, it's rather like someone, you know, I'm helping mom with a little balcony garden, and everyone hears about this every weekend. But that's all I do. So now, last year we had 57 plants, potted plants. This year we have 65. So I'm not practicing renunciation here. And this makes mom very happy. And this is the third year running where we've had cucumbers. Now, last year I noticed, and probably the year before, I noticed that some of the cucumbers just aren't coming ripe. So I asked people, say, too much water. I asked another person, not enough water. Too much fertilizer, not enough fertilizer. And last week, someone here, Dawn, said, they're not getting pollinated. Ah. Now then I looked at the plant again, and I said, of course, there's a male and there's a female. There's two different flowers on the same plant. Now, that's 3 years I haven't noticed this. I go and, you know, I water these things and I take care of them, but I never really noticed. I saw the flowers, but I never noticed that there's a male and a female. And then as soon as she described that, and now, of course, now why didn't I notice that before? So now I take the cotton bud, and I'm trying, because I'm on the fourth floor, so I'm not getting much bees up there. I don't think you're getting bees anywhere now. And that's, the Dhamma's like that. It's like the Buddha is describing something, and when you really take it in, you say, oh yeah, why didn't I notice that? Of course, that's how you make cucumbers. So right understanding is that. It's like the teaching describes something for us, but it's not just an abstract. It's not like just descriptions for the sake of some kind of intellectual entertainment. It's not analysis for the sake of being clever. It's not views that are sort of Buddhist, so to make you a good Buddhist. We don't want to become conditioned Buddhists. What's the point? We want to be free. So the point of the teaching is not just to have a bunch of Buddhist ideas as opposed to Christian ideas or Islamic traditions ideas. It's to have a set of ideas that liberate the mind, and that's right understanding. So right understanding is different than just having an opinion about Buddhism. I can believe in good karma and bad karma, but if I don't understand what that means in terms of intentional action, what's the point of it? I just have an opinion. So right understanding then is what influences samaditti. Right understanding influences samasankappa, doesn't it? Samasankappa is right thought. And what is thought? Thought is the way I intend to live my life, isn't it? I'm gonna do this or I'm gonna do that. That's what it's about. It's not just about vague thoughts about Buddhism. It's about the way I'm directing my mind. So you could call it kind of like right aspiration or right intention. One of the words I like from Indian philosophy, sadhana. Sadhana is, I don't know if you use it in Sri Lanka, but sadhana is like your life work, or your vocation. So like right now, my sadhana is caring for mom. When I'm dying, when this body is dying, my sadhana will be death, will be the dying process. If your child is a teenager and comes home with blue hair, that's your sadhana. Like it or not, that's what you practice with. And the idea of sadhana is that these challenges that life presents to us are something that I'm going to learn from. They're not just hassles. They're not just my bad karma. That kind of fatalism, oh, my child has blue hair, it's my bad karma. No, my child has blue hair and I don't want blue hair. And I'm worried and I don't know what to do. That turmoil that I'm facing, or the doubt, or the worry, the anger, that's the lab, that's the experimental lab which I'm going to learn about myself. Of the Four Noble Truths, right? And that's a part of right intention, to use this human birth in a way where I learn from the difficulties, where I learn from the suffering, rather than difficulties just being bad karma. Because that doesn't, you know, you can call it bad karma, good karma, or in-between karma. It doesn't really help you. I have a friend. She doesn't want to win the lotto. You know why? She doesn't want to use up all her good karma in one shot. That's an interesting one. I never thought of that. But that, though, so we have very kind of fatalistic ideas of good karma and bad karma. But karma really is intention. Vipaka is the result of that. And beyond like, say, in Montreal, there was this poor woman. You probably read about that. She went into the Marriott Hotel in an atrium. She said, "I want that chair." She sat down on that chair, and a concrete slab came down to the 18th floor and crushed her. She was dead. In Buddhism, we probably say that's bad karma. She was just flat and dead. So we think, well, she must have done something to get it, to get that kind of result. Maybe, we don't know. And that's speculative ideas about karma, and we love to do that. We love to speculate. And somehow that can be soothing. You know, we can say, well, yeah, okay. But karma really is about action. It's about the moment. It's about your intentions. Vipaka is about the result of those intentions. And what we can know for sure, beyond our speculation, is that when I function from clarity, and when I make clear decisions, the results are clear. And I can see that this direction is good, and another direction maybe is bad. It doesn't work. This works. Huh? And that kind of clarity then can give us a lot of confidence. And that's what we can really trust in. Kusala and Sumedha didn't make it to the Dana. Right? Grandchildren. And so Hemanta and Nisanka planned it all out, got this all organized, and Kusala's plane couldn't land in Ottawa. She went to Toronto, and they didn't make it, right? And that's life, isn't it? It's uncertain. It's uncertain. You just don't know. You can lay it all out and plan it all out and then replay it tomorrow. Now, if we only done this and we only done that, but you can replay it all you want, but it'll never come out perfect. So you can only do the best you can. But what you know for sure is your intentions. You don't know quite what's going to come at you, but you can know your intentions. So if Kusala's on the plane, and the plane can't land, and she starts to get uptight, and she says, "Ah, this is a feeling of being uptight," then she's fully conscious. And she says, "Well, I gave it a go, let go," and she relaxes. That's right intention. Good karma, right? If she's sitting on a plane getting uptight, and then she continues to be uptight for 2 hours, then that intention, of course, creates suffering in her mind. So each situation that comes to us is always this kind of a challenge. Life is sadhana. You know, the landing of the plane is part of your sadhana. The disappointment of we have a leaking light in the kitchen now, right? In the kitchen of the main house. So these diligent chaps have pulled apart the shower and they're looking for the leak. Now you could say, if showers didn't have leaks, I'd be happy, right? And in my family, we used to say, if your mother had wheels, she'd be a bus. Showers have leaks. Planes don't make it. So the external life is very unsure. And that is the Ajahn Chah often taught that, didn't he? Maine. We were joking about this on the drive here. Maine, uncertainty. It's uncertain. Anicca, it's uncertain. But what is certain is that when we awaken and when we make right intentions, that's the best we can do. And when we act on those intentions, when we live those intentions, that's the best we can do. And the rest, we don't know. We're not sure. Maine. In Western philosophy, they say the road to hell is paved with good intentions. That's Western philosophy. It's not Buddhist philosophy. The road to hell is paved with stupid intentions. You know, I don't know where, probably that means that the road to hell is paved with good intentions for people who don't follow up on their intentions. But in Buddhism, intention is like in every moment, in every thought, in every action, in every word that we do, intention is involved in that. So karma is always being created. Now, so we think of those who we love who have died, But then we have to reflect on our own death too. Not when are we going to die, we will die. We will die for sure, right? And then, so what is the best approach to that? What would be a good dying? What would be a good dying? I often think about with Mom now, she's 93. What can I do to facilitate a good living? Definitely, medication and a 65 pots. We're about to get 66 next year. I don't know if she's around. That's part of it. But what about a good dying? What's that? What does that imply? Well, I think in caring for someone, I think it implies freeing them up, that they don't have to worry about the worldly things. We don't hassle them. They can work through their own process. We encourage them, that we reassure them, but they can work through their own process. So I can see with my mother now, caring for her, she doesn't have to worry about medicine or food or whatever. She can just be in her own process and learn what she has to learn and do what she has to do. So there's that part of someone dying. But then our own part in that, as we're dying, what could be the best thing? And the best thing would be the good karma we've been created with our good intentions. If I've really used this life to be fully conscious, I've really made an effort to be fully awake and fully conscious. And this is a constant effort. You just have to keep awakening the mind, because the mind can go off and fall asleep so easily. So if I do that, and I keep making intentions based on wholesomeness, based on affection, based on compassion, based on renunciation, based on wisdom. If I keep doing that with sincerity, then I can, as the dying process happens, said, yeah, I really gave it a good go. I really used this life well. There can be a sense of confidence, a sense of fulfillment. But if this life isn't used well, if it's just used in trivial pursuit or competition or worry or whatever, it's not used as sadhana, as practice, as a vehicle for liberation. If it's not used in that way, then surely a dying must be very confusing. What was that about? What was this whole life about? What's the point of this? Did I use it well? Did I not do it well? McNamara, the architect of the Vietnam War, he just died. You might have read that. And I was in university when the Vietnam War was in full flight. Two of my brother monks were in the Vietnam War. And he was not very popular. But it's interesting, when he finally started to contemplate the Vietnam War, a tremendous regret, tremendous remorse from being the architect of that war. And so you think about his dying. His dying must have been so befuddled with that memory, with that doubt and that regret. And that's an extreme of a life lived without wisdom, a life lived from just some kind of idea. Clever. It was a clever life, but it was not a wise life at all in that way. And then there's the regret and the remorse. But when we live from wisdom and full consciousness and make decisions to really clear decisions, clear intentions, then the results are clarity. And then our death has more chance of being clear, because we're not carrying a lot of baggage and regret and remorse. And our dying, whatever the transition is, however consciousness transforms and moves and changes, we have a chance to be there. It can be an interesting thing rather than just a kind of befuddled thing and confused thing. Ajahn Chah would say, die before you die. And he would say, like, let go of the ego, let go of all that troubled mind, and learn to live in the present, learn to be awake to the present. So may the goodness of our gathering, the wholesomeness of our generosity here in sharing this meal and sharing this day, the wholesomeness of listening to Dhamma, the wholesomeness of our aspirations, be a benefit to Hemanta's mom and Gamini's dad and my dad and your dad and everyone else's parents and loved ones. Hey, well.